You're listening to Road to Black Tech Week, where culture, capital, and creativity collide. And today, I'm bringing you a masterclass in movement building with Sandy Moore, Chief Impact Officer at Advantage Capital and the powerhouse behind Empower the Change, a fund led by Black leaders for Black communities. Sandy guides you from standing firm in your investment thesis to rethinking what LP engagement really looks like to navigating the pressure to close before you're ready. This is a convo about raising capital with conviction, with community, and on your own terms. If you're raising big and dreaming bigger, this one's for you. Black Tech Week 2025, July 14th through the 16th in Cincinnati. Go to blacktechweek.com and get in the room. Let's go.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. So excited to be here. My name is Vanessa Stevens. As stated, I'm a private equity attorney that works for a large asset manager. I focus on negotiating venture capital transactions across impact investing, across sustainability funds, and several other sectors and industries. So very excited to be here with the esteemed Sandy Moore to discuss raising your first fund. Fundraising is an important aspect of creating your startup, but how do you get to your first piece of funding, especially when everything seems so new? Sandy Moore is a multidimensional leader, the Chief Impact Officer and Managing Director at Advantage Capital. Advantage Capital is a growth equity focused $3.8 billion AUM investment firm, supporting almost 1,000 businesses by creating more than 66,000 jobs. Ms. Moore is also a lawyer by training. She's grounded her early work in equity and advocacy as an EEOC administrative judge, hearing civil rights discriminatory matters focused on employment. She later moved on to the governor's office, developing policy as a director at the Missouri Department of Labor and Industrial Relations. Ms. Moore has also been an executive in both nonprofit and for-profit organizations, addressing affordable housing challenges, creating mixed income housing, and rebuilding distressed urban communities. Of her current role, Ms. Moore says she's learned that the private sector is going to drive the equity and change that she wants to see in the world. Please join me in welcoming Ms. Sandy Moore.
Thank you, Vanessa.
Of course. So Ms. Moore, we're here to talk about fundraising a first fund, and you're at Advantage Capital focused on investing in small businesses at the growth stage, like we said. You're in the middle of a fundraise right now. Can you tell us a little bit about the fund that you're currently raising and how you and your team developed the investment thesis and set the focus of your course?
Sure, but let me say first of all that I'm ecstatic to be here. I'm here because I have a relationship with a couple of the leaders in the management of this event. But I've read and heard about it a lot, and I cannot believe that I've missed it and just got here. And it's been a blast. I just had to come in and leave this evening, but next year I will make certain I'm here for a while. Now, to your question. First of all, can I little context? So Advantage Capital has gotten bigger since you and I last talked, about 4.5 billion assets under management. It's a 31-year-old firm. It's an impact investing firm. It's invest in growth, both debt and equity, so it's a hybrid fund, in distressed urban and rural core communities, distressed urban core and rural communities. And the impact that we seek at Advantage is primary, secondary, and tertiary job outcomes, high wage, high productivity, high opportunity jobs with great benefits that really drive some change in the community. Chief Impact Officer, I pay attention to all of that. I sit on investment committee. I vote on every deal. You can't get to an investment from Advantage without having meeting or exceeding the 75 impact score in the impact matrix that I have helped develop. So that's the framework. The fund that I started is called Empower the Change. It's about 2 years old now. It's a target $200 million fund. We're in the process of resetting the target, and we will talk about that as we go on. But the investment thesis is that if we remove the barriers to providing growth capital to Black and Brown and Native American and businesses, that whole BIPOC spectrum, if we remove the barriers to growth capital and we structure the capital infusion in a way that makes it possible for the Black and Brown entrepreneur to really make good business decisions toward the creation of their own wealth and thereby the elimination of the wealth gap, that we can in fact demonstrably eliminate the wealth gap and do it profitably. Why do we know this? Because we've done this at Advantage Capital for 31 years, but without the intentionality around race and equity. As just a side point, when I started looking at standing up Empower the Change, I did had some of my team members. I have data and media, data and communications in my shop, and we did a little regression analysis to see what our investment background had been over the last 30 years. And accidentally, Advantage had invested $250 million in 70 BIPOC businesses. So I said to my partners, I'm the first Black and the first woman in the firm, partner in the firm. I said, if you did it accidentally and we've made money at it, how about we put our minds to it and do it for real? And so that was the emergence of Empower the Change. And that's the investment thesis. And we've built both the architecture and the infrastructure of the fund to support that thesis. I'll stop there.
And so important, right? Yeah, we talked about the importance of having like growth equity in the space. We have a lot of seed stage, a lot of earlier stage investors, but growth equity is certainly important. So wanted to talk about staying true to that investment thesis. So several emerging investment managers, even seasoned investment managers, are on the road right now, and they're frequently faced with pushback from LPs on that investment thesis. As you're in the middle of these conversations right now, how do you balance the tension between staying true to your investment thesis and closing over capital commitments? Do you have any stories from the road that you can share about your lessons learned staying the course that you just described?
Yes and yes. You can stay the course. It's not easy, especially in fundraising, because you want to go where the money tells you to go. But out of experience, my own experience before moving into the private equity world, where I spent a lot of years leading a large not-for-profit that worked exclusively with mixed income and affordable housing developers in very complex deals, for-profit developers. So that's really where I cut my chops on understanding the capital stack and how you raise it and so forth and so on. And I learned there, if you chase the dollars, you'll never be able to show the outcomes that you seek. And I know that sounds easy to say now, me sitting here, but that has to be the bottom line. That has to be your foundation, that you're going to stay focused on the outcome that you seek and not let the pull of the money drive you off of it, because you will not succeed. You won't get done what you set out to do. You won't get the personal fulfillment of having done what you set out to do, and you're not likely to please all the people that you are chasing the money for. So that's the Auntie Sandy overall big picture. Recently, in raising Empower, we're at about $75 million, and we see a sight line down to $150 million before we close the fund. Our big problem that we had to struggle to stay true to was being a hybrid fund. You know, Everybody wanted us to say, oh, you're going to do debt. Then, okay, you're a private capital fund, and we might have some money for you over here. Look this way, Sandy. Or they say, you're an equity fund. Just choose one or the other, and we've got some money for you over here. Look this way, Sandy. And what our analysis has told us, what 30 years of experience at Advantage told us, and I was relying on that to help to back up the fund so that we had some investment history that we could point to, even though we're a new standalone majority-minority owned fund. That was important to me, because you can't go into equity conversations with prospective companies if in fact your equity investment might disvest them of their minority status. That would be the opposite of what we are trying to do. So Empower is majority minority owned, but I wanted the experience, the 30 years worth of experience of investors who'd been doing this and making a lot of money at it. So the thing that we had to say was, the data tells us that this is the kind of money that black and brown businesses that have been operating fine, but are stuck, can't go to the next level, can't pass on to their children or another a business that is interested so that they can retire, can't merge and acquire so that they can grow, can't exit and be a serial entrepreneur doing other things, or exit and just go lay on the beach. You know, black and brown entrepreneurs get to do that too. And what we had to say was, the data tells us this is what they need, and stay with me. I know you all will get it. At the growth equity stage for BIPOC businesses, the structural barriers have been, we don't have regularized banking relationships, so there's no bank that we can just walk into and say, hey, you know, I've been doing good for the last 25 years, give me a little hustle on this. We've already, if we're at a growth equity stage, we've already tapped whatever minor or modest, and maybe some of you are wealthy and you had plenty of friends and family money, but you've tapped that. We have no more collateralization. We need money above collateralization, so we need some equity. But we need that equity in a way that is not going to destroy the ownership, believe the ownership, framework of that business. And so we relied on data. We relied on, I'm a social scientist by training, so I relied on the social facts that I just shared with you about the flaws in the fundraising continuum. We relied on experience that Advantage, the frame that I worked from, had been doing what we call dequity for years. We relied on Empower is a black-led firm, so we can bridge the trust gap when we go in to talk to black and brown businesses about equity. And so far, it has worked. It has made the fundraise long and slow. So I know what it is when I say, stay true to your theses. But it isn't easy, but you can do it using the kinds of things that I just shared with you.
Now, so important to stay true to your course. And you just touched on this a little bit too. Fundraising is definitely a long game. And doing the many months that the LPs are raising or GPs are raising, the market can change. Yes. And therefore LP deployment can change. A lot of factors can be changing in those conversations. Can you share a little bit about, a little advice of how GPs can be thinking about the timing of their first closing? You touched a little bit about changing AUM targets and capital commitment targets. Mm-hmm. So maybe talk about that as well. And then how do you think about when the fund is ready to start deploying its capital, even if you're in the middle of the fundraising process?
Ooh,
it's a lot.
That's a lot. And have done it all, seen it all, and done the rest. So let me pull it apart and talk about the timing of the first close. I really missed the mark on that, and I had a hint. I closed, the first close was too early. And one of our GPs, and it's all public now, so I can share, U.S. Bank, CDC is headquartered in St. Louis, and I'd done a lot of business with that bank individually, and Advantage had done a lot of business, so we had good relationships there. And I sought to close the first one. We put in our LP documents, we had, and our GP documents, we set multiple closings, and I advised that, with a floor of $25 million. So you had to get to $25 million before you could do a first close. We got to $50 million, and you know, my heart was going pitter-patter, and it was all in the midst of all these pronouncements about what all the world was going to do following the murder of George Floyd and the civil unrest, which is where I came to decide that Empower the Change was what we wanted to do. And so pitter-patter, $51 million, let's go. And we did a first close. But our friend at U.S. Bank said, Sandy, why are you doing a first close? You got an 8-year period on this fund, 4 years to raise and deploy, and 4 years to harvest. That's already short. So why don't you wait a little while, get a little more? Because the environment could change. And I look back and say, that was good advice, but did he jinx us? Because the environment seriously changed. So be careful about that. Be careful about not letting getting to a good mark on your raise kind of pushing you to, hey, yeah, I'm ready to go. And take a bit longer look against your total. And I would say that you need to get about 50% of that total before you do that first close. That would be my hindsight now. And that's what he was urging me. He said to me, I can remember like yesterday, Sandy, when you get to 100 million, that lets people know that you're serious and sustainable as a fund. And I was like, oh, we were at 50.1 million. We're obviously gonna get to 100 million. Well, that was a year and a half ago. And we'll get there. So that's the first thing. Just be thoughtful about your close. People understand. LPs and fund supporters understand, and fund managers know fundraising is hard. And the more targeted you are in what you are raising for, the more difficult it is. So you got to be in it for the long haul, and you can't get antsy. Now, the next part of your question was, okay, well, what, when the market changes, what about resetting goals and whatnot? I think that the most important thing I can share about that is to raise funds, you put your credibility on the line. LPs invest in people and great ideas with structure, at least in the growth capital world. A lot more risk-taking adventure. And so therefore, it is absolutely true, important to be true and ethical and credible. So if I'm at 75 million, a year and a half in, and I've got a year left on my raise, it's not nearly as credible as you as I want to be to say, oh yeah, we're going to get to 200 million. So I've begun talking to our pipeline LPs and saying, and I've said it this way, too many eyes in this because I've got a great team. We, our team, have said to people, we're going to stop the raise at this point. And here's what we think we will reach. And we're going to stop the raise at this point so that because we've got a short deploy and harvest window so that we can get to work. So in other words, if you find that you look at the fundraising horizon and credibly you think you need to make an adjustment so that LPs can understand that and that this is a team that we can trust and believe in, then develop the theory for the change and then go and do and make the adjustment. Now I have to say one thing, just recently, because it feels like I fundraise 22 hours a day. And it's because I fundraise 22 hours a day. And recently, just this week, a prospective funder said, you're fundraising in the mid, your fund has a lot of LPs from the Midwest. And this was a East Coast potential fund opportunity. And there's so much money in the Midwest, you're going to send the wrong message. You're sending a message if you cut your goal short that there's something wrong here. So that happened this week. Honestly, I haven't had time to digest it and test it with people whom I trust. But I'm sharing it with you because it's a real life story, and there's the balancing that has to happen between our credibility against the time rate, the timeline that we've already spent, versus the what messaging are we sending? And you just have to balance it out. I don't know the answer yet on what that comment might mean to Empower.
Yeah. No, I do want to touch on how you build that narrative and your ongoing conversations with LPs after you close on capital. Curious though, specifically about changing your AUM target. You talked a little bit about like the conversation that you had with LPs and reframing the goal. Could you take us maybe a step before that to what that conversation looked like with your team mm-hmm. about resetting the target?
Yes. And that conversation with my team is the reason that makes me say, I've got to spend some time unpacking what I heard from a very large prospective funder this week. But with the team, we said, we've got this. We can get to 125 million for certain, and then we have some LPs that lead us to a kicker in the way that it's structured if we get there. So we can see our way to 150. Mm. And we've already made our first investment, and we've got a rich pipeline, and our team said, let's go. Let's get money on the ground. Let's prove concept. Let's wrap this up successfully and be ready for fund two. So we did not make the decision out of any sense that we can't raise the money. We made it out of a sense of this economy is fickle. Yeah. And our black and brown businesses, we've got 25, 26 in completed early diligence in the pipeline. Let's get the money out there. I'm gonna bet on us. We get the money out there, those businesses grow and prove concept, and we'll do a fund too. So that was our thinking. But you know, we're all talking to ourselves and talking to each other. The woman with the money said, you better be careful, so.
No, that definitely makes sense. I do want to touch on that. We're gonna pivot to audience questions here momentarily. So I want you all to be thinking of questions to ask Sandy as well. You did talk a little bit about the feedback that you're getting back from your LP base as you're communicating the investment thesis and strategy. Could you talk a little bit about how you keep your LP base updated? The investment cycle is very long. So mm-hmm. if you close over, you know, your first LP, maybe in the first couple months, if you've been fundraising for 18, 20 months, how do you keep those folks, those early stage folks engaged?
Well, we've been religious about a quarterly update. It's just a page and a half, two pages, that tells LPs where we are. I am wickedly focused on LP relations management. So I reach out to the LPs, I ask them questions, I follow what's happening in their businesses, we send them press clippings, we give them the opportunity to hear stories about the businesses in our pipeline. So it's a very, very, very high touch. Now, let me tell you something about that that I do believe is slightly generational. In case you all hadn't noticed, I'm not a school girl. I know, it's hard for y'all to believe that, I know. And I believe that the more novel or aggressive or counterintuitive the matter that you are pushing, the more time and care and feeding you have to put in. Now, my 30-something-year-old daughter is like, Ma, that's that old school stuff. Some of this stuff is plain, it's seen, it's the systems have not worked, and I'm not holding this person's hand and calling that person. She's probably right. When I grow up, I want to be her. But I think really it's in the middle right now. And what we are seeking to do to jump over the structural barriers that have kept Black and Brown and Native American and every other kind of diverse business from getting to growth capital, it's there. And from my old school perspective, let me manage you as closely as I need to for you to feel like you're part of a change initiative. That's all I know, and that's what I do. I want to be like some of you all and maybe do less, but in the meantime, maybe we meet in the middle.
Absolutely. And honestly, you have to be mindful the institutional investor probably is very accustomed to the old guard ways of communication strategy and things like that. So you can't pivot the ship too quickly. Any questions for the audience? We have a few more things that we wanted to talk through. Yes. We'll actually take questions right here at the mic. And if you could introduce yourself, let us know your name and where you're from.
Good afternoon, Venor July. I'm actually a corporate partner at a firm in DC, but I live in Baltimore. One of the things I want to just kind of dig into is something that you said that seems somewhat counterintuitive to me. So a lot of my, because of the financial, the way that the markets are looking now, a lot of the people who I represent who are raising funds are actually cutting back on how much they are trying to raise. They had made these bigger proclamations and realized it was going to be a much harder path to get into that.
That's right.
But you mentioned that when you were thinking about doing your first close, that thought might have been that you should have waited longer. And I'm trying to understand that because it would seem as if you get to the first close earlier, then you can deploy capital, start proving concept, and then potentially still have the opportunity to have secondary and tertiary closes. And so kind of just trying to understand the thinking behind, particularly recognize that people are raising smaller funds, why you would wait until you get to 50% before you actually close out the fund.
That is a very good question. And it is rooted in the architecture of the fund. Our fund has a lot of bank LPs in it. And from that perspective, bank LPs were, that comment came to me from a bank LP. I told you that, US Bank. And that thinking was, banks are gonna do this because it meets CRA requirements, because it meets internal goals that they've set. And you can wait and get further down the line and and have a bigger slug to draw in those who don't have a ready need for investing in the fund. So I think that answer is very technical to the architecture of Empower the Change, because you're right. Our team, seasoned investment folk, was exactly where you are. Let's close as soon as we doubled our mark, and let's start deploying. But the other technicality is we had LPs that had put sort of limits on because they're banks, what percentage of the fund they would ever be. And so we didn't have as much investable capital as we would have liked at that point. So I think it's technical, and our intuition was like your intuition. And I think probably you've corrected me that with smaller funds, that intuition is the best. But still be very thoughtful about who your LPs are and how they might be looking at this.
Hi, Auntie. I'm Alexis. I'm hoping to really be your niece one day. So if you have an assistant, I would love to share my law school statement I prepared for Yale Law School. I was actually exposed to tax credit lending, so you are just such a perfect example. But I wanted to ask a question probably on behalf of everybody here today. You have mentioned three keys, which was great people, great ideas, and structure. So assuming all of us meet the first two keys, can you give us a blueprint on the structure that you're looking for or would recommend?
You're going to get into Yale Law School because that's a tough question. First, your investment thesis. Next, I mean, it really needs to be clear and logical and tight and connected to the financing markets. When we first started, my investment partners, when we were practicing our pitches, would say, okay, Cindy, that's enough about all that's wrong in the world. We need to talk about what we're going to do with this money. Yeah. So the thesis, then the infrastructure and the architecture of your fund, how in true investing world will you work backwards to achieving your thesis with that architecture and with that structure? And then where do you get the experience? Mm-hmm. Very, very important, because that's part of the people part that is important. You know, there is no way that I could have raised this fund alone. People would have taken my calls and my conversations based on years of being involved in complex business deals and all the other stuff. But you need the investment chops, and that's what my partners brought to it. So those are the pieces of the structure that I think are very important.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Hello, thank you for being here today. My name is Nia Thomas. I currently serve as the manager of social justice advocacy for the Center for Social Justice here in Cincinnati through the Urban League. I was very interested in the fact that you mentioned, obviously as a lawyer, your background's in the social sciences. And I'm curious, as my personal mission is to aid in the liberation of Black people. I'm getting introduced to this space and trying to really understand what does it take for us to build a society that's prepared for abolition. And I'm recognizing that within a capitalistic society, that requires capital. And so I've been more intrigued and open to the venture capital space. So I'm just curious to hear, how do you think your background in social sciences, law and policy inform your work in VCs?
Because you've already answered your question. In a capitalist society, capital is what drives change. And it took me 30 years to finally come to the conclusion that there wasn't enough government money, there wasn't enough philanthropy, there was not enough friends and family money to drive the changes that I cared about as a human. And private capital. I watch it do it every single day. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I got there.
I'm sorry, y'all. I gotta ask a follow-up. But I guess if you could speak a little bit more to what it's like navigating VC spaces, having had came from that background. I know you have obviously mentioned your experience in business partnerships. Mm-hmm. But I know I can be a bit radical even in social sciences spaces. So just curious of what that's like for you.
Well, there's one thing that we, and then we're going to get off of this and you and I can get in the hallway. But there is one piece of my background that we didn't talk a whole lot here. I grew a business. Mm-hmm. I took over a not-for-profit and it had two employees. I brought one, my assistant, with me, and it's 16 and it had $750,000 is what the guy who convinced me to do it told me he had. And I had just come off of a gig where I was leading a department that had a budget of $531 million. And I was like, what did I have for breakfast when I told you I would take this job? Because whatever it was, I don't want to eat it anymore.
Must have been really
But
good.
I grew that business to 114 employees and a $12 to $14 million top-line revenue company in 16 years. And that, more than anything, is where I learned, and it was a not-for-profit. Mm-hmm. So that's a large not-for-profit. And I never had a fundraiser. I didn't do any of that. We ate what we killed in the comprehensive community development world. And that, more than anything, is what drew venture capital and not so much venture, but private equity firms to me when I decided to leave because I had demonstrated the ability to understand and grow a business.
Thank you. I look forward to connecting further.
Yes.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good.
My name is Garrett Clinton. I'm from McKenna Capital based in Palo Alto. We're an LP. And so I come to this from the LP perspective.
Got any money? I'm still
We have a fair share. And so part of what I do in McKenna is kind of lead our sort of our diverse manager search and understanding the hurdles that come with that come with the institutional side and the investment committee world and these people who are trying to tap into a network that they understandably haven't had access to before.
That's right.
And so that's been part of the project that I've been doing. But one thing I've noticed in meeting with Fund Ones is that my fear is that the further we get away from 2020 and the post-George Floyd influx of capital, there's going to be a tightening where some of these banks are not going to re-up with your fund too, or some of these corporate sponsors are not going to re-up because the partnership and the relationship wasn't as strong. And so they're just kind of just checking a box for their fund one, they're allocating dollars. But I think my question to you is, how as a GP are you all kind of being selective with your LPs and thinking about how that carries to your next funds?
That is an excellent question. There's just a whole lot of entities, and I have to be very careful because this stuff will probably show up somewhere publicly. That's all y'all do is Insta.
But you can keep it real, though.
But there are very 6 months in, we just decided that there was a whole lot of talking that didn't have any money behind it. Or if it had money behind it, it was going to be first-time money. And so we narrowed our reach for LPs to LPs that we knew we could deliver something that they needed. That's why we have so many banks, because they're going to need that CRA credit. And as the CRA rules and regulations have changed, it becomes harder for them to get that credit. And we have been meticulous about making certain that the outcomes that for the fund are CRA likely, because you can never say for sure that, but we focused on investing in low and moderate income communities. We are Volcker compliant. So in any way, without the technicalities, we went looking for LPs that we knew we had something that they needed. And I have just not pursued a lot of big talkers out there that have been talking for the last 75 to 100 years. Mm-hmm. I'm just too old. Yep.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. My name is Chase. I'm from Tulsa. We run a femtech social enterprise called Sanico.us. I'm the chief period officer because we're trying to get more men in the conversation around period and also help end period poverty. We like the amazing stride you've done at Advantage Capital, and we'd like to invite you to Tulsa because we have amazing black entrepreneurs who are doing a lot in going beyond just profits and revenue. And impact investment has been a word that has been so catchy during my days at the UN, mm-hmm. but truly a lot of investors, like we've had to turn down a $650,000 investment because the investor was really all about equity. They wanted to take about 16.5% in our business. They were not really concerned about the impact of how we wanted to get into the community, right. give people access to period product and all. So my question would be like, where do we draw the line as tech entrepreneurs, especially for those in the feminine hygiene space where even black male investors are not even interested to hear that catchy word like, is menstruation cancer? Are people really struggling from this? How do you help us draw the line, and how do you think you can even come into Tulsa and invest in our company? Thank you.
Well, first of all, thank you for the work. It's important work in this country. People think it's just important work in third world countries, but it isn't. Secondly, we're already in Tulsa. And third, let's just talk about it. Okay?
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Denora. I'm the founder and CEO of the Nori Project Incorporated. I am a former attorney, criminal justice, specifically public defender, and I'm very new to this entrepreneurial space. So I started my corporation 10 months ago, and within that time, I've graduated an accelerator and got my first large investment. But my question to you is, do you have any advice on attorneys, former attorneys, people with that JD navigating this entrepreneurial scene, especially when it comes to gaining VC dollars?
No. But I don't think there's any such thing as a former attorney.
What do you mean by that?
I mean that, and I'm very serious about that, I mean that probably a significant portion of the reason that you've been able to move as quickly as you have is because of the education and the training and the thought processes that good lawyers are trained in. So I believe you use everything you got to get what you want. So drop that former.
Okay. Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
You probably have time for two more questions, so it's perfect.
Sweet. My name is Brandon Thomas. I'm a recent OSU graduate. I was curious to know, what advice would you give someone who wants to raise their own fund?
Know why you want to raise it? And this is going to sound like a silly answer, but I don't intend it to be. When I led a large not-for-profit, and before it got so big, I would participate in interviews for most of the employees. Then I got to a point, obviously, where I couldn't do that. But I always asked the question, how do we make money? And honestly, early on, I screened out anybody who told me, well, this is a not-for-profit. Because I'm like, okay, well, what's that got to do with the price of beans? That is that what I'm going to say to you when it's time for your paycheck to cash? I don't think so. If you don't know how we make money, not-for-profit is a business organizational structure, and it got nothing to do with running a business. Is a business is a business. A fund is a fund is a fund. You want to raise your first fund, and you need to know why you want to raise it, what it is you seek to achieve, what you're going to do with the money. And if it is, well, you know, that's a good lucrative business, that VC and PE space, which I hear a lot from young black and brown business. How do I get into PE? Well, what do you want to do? So that's my answer.
Hi, Thank you so much. So my name is Damara West, and I'm founder of Be Well, Beautiful Woman. We help women to center their healing and liberation so that they can lead and live lives on their own terms. So I operate as a social enterprise. I'm a for-profit entity, but I have a not-for-profit partner that allows philanthropic dollars to come in and provide up to full needs-based scholarships for the work that we do. But it's based in Kalamazoo County. So it's a global wellness community, but the scholarship dollars are just for Kalamazoo County because that's where the funder happens to be. So the next iteration of my work will be to develop a tiny home retreat center. I'm investigating whether or not I'm going to go the philanthropic route to try to fund this project because it would have like a 60-40 market rate split where 40% of usage would be available up to full needs-based scholarships for organizations along with individuals. So my question is that as a social enterprise, knowing that I'm a for-profit entity with this focus around financial accessibility, if I was looking at getting funders for a project such as this, what would you recommend?
Foundations.
Period.
Period.
So I should go the philanthropic route, period.
No, that's not what I mean. I say foundations because they have the range of investment options that you need. Foundations do PRIs, you know, and those are not grants. Those are profit, the profit-based, and there's going to be some payment back. So foundations have a range of things from grants to forgivable loans to PRIs, and that is what I think provides the range of potential funding opportunities of the first choice for a social enterprise.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Thank you all so much for your questions. And thank you so much, Sandy, for your words of wisdom. I always like to end these fireside chats on a silver lining or words of encouragement. So we talked about the fact that the LP base, the dollars are also kind of tightening.
Yes.
When it comes to impact investment funds, when it comes to funds that are investing in diverse founders. Could you leave us with some words of encouragement for folks that are out here fundraising right now? Any advice?
Yeah, don't believe it. Black and brown people in this country have never really believed what was in front of them. Otherwise, we would have stopped long ago. Mm-hmm. Don't believe it. Keep driving forward, but obviously, you got to retool your messages as you need them. Not your mission, not your focus, but your messages. You got to get tighter. You got to do 23 hours a day worth of fundraising instead of 22. But I think that there is still enormous opportunity to do what we need to do to break these funding barriers that hamper the GDP growth of this country. We are turning into a country that is remarkably beige, which means that that's where the growth opportunity is. Don't stop chasing it because it's hard. Because it's just as rewarding on the other side.
That's true. That's true. Well, thank you so much. Join me in thanking Sandy. Thank you all.
That was Sandy Moore, Vision in Action, and proof that we can move capital and culture at the same time. If her words hit home, pass it on. Subscribe to Road to Black Tech Week, drop us a review, and share this with someone navigating with their first raise with heart and hustle. And pull up in person. Black Tech Week 2025 is where bold ideas get funded. July 14th through the 16th in Cincinnati. Visit blacktechweek.com. Until next time, lead with purpose, back your boldness, and build what you believe in.